Heard kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, technical difficulties prevented my scheduled interview today, but it's not a problem. We have decades of archived conversations that are still trenchant and useful. First, we will revisit the conversation we had in August 2017 in the wake of the Unite the Right march in Charlottesville, Virginia. Writer and podcaster Adam Johnson had thoughts about the way so-called mainstream news media responded to a straight-up celebration of white supremacy. Also on the show, if we are to believe the chest thumping, high on Trump's agenda will be the enforced criminalization of migration. We talked about that in July of 2018 with Jacinta Gonzalez, senior campaign organizer at Mi Gente. The past is never dead. It's not even past. This week on Counterspin. But first, a look at some recent press. Asked for his morning after assessment of what happened on MSNBC's Morning Joe, pundit Chris Matthews fumed about the Biden administration's supposed open border. Quote, "Immigration has been a terrible decision for Democrats. I don't know who they think they were playing to when they let millions of people come cruising through the border at their own will. Because of their own decisions, they came right running to that border, and they didn't do a thing about it." Close quote. You couldn't hope for a more distorted picture of Biden administration immigration policy from Fox or from Alex Jones. They didn't do a thing about it. Over here in reality land, Joe Biden deported, turned back, and expelled more than 4 million immigrants and refugees through February 2024, more than Donald Trump excluded during his entire first term. Groups like Human Rights Watch criticized Biden for continuing many of Trump's brutal anti-asylum policies. The ACLU called the restrictions unconstitutional. So it's a serious question. How can we expect news media to platform, forget fair or inclusive, how can we expect them to platform a rational debate about what the nation's approach to immigration might be when the supposedly liberal 24-hour news network is pretending that Biden's immigration policies amount to an open border? The New York Times Upshot published a chart showing that since 1980, the income of white men without college degrees has fallen compared to that of white, Asian, Latina, and Black women with college degrees. This illustrates the Times' claim that, quote, "the economy has effectively devalued the work and skills of some Americans while delivering mounting rewards to others," close quote. Why does the Times compare white men without college degrees to these people, rather than making the more obvious comparison to Black, Latino, and Asian men without college degrees, all of whom have lower average incomes. The Times could also have noted that white women without college degrees make much less money than their male counterparts, and that white men with college degrees make much more than those without. As University of Maryland sociologist Philip Cohen explained, the way the Times presented this data is, quote, basically the story of rising returns to education turned into a story of race-gender grievance, close quote. That fits in well with the Times' history of trying to explain to liberals why they should learn to love white resentment. And finally, after Israel assassinated the leader of Hamas, a New York Times headline seemed to express surprise that killing a negotiating partner did not turn out to be a pathway to peace. Yahya Sinwar is dead, but a Palestinian state still seems distant, was the headline. And that followed another Times report that took a similar line. Despite Sinwar's death, Mideast peace may still be elusive. At The Nation, Laura Albast and Sarah O'Neill remind us that among the tens of thousands of Palestinians that Israel has killed since October 7th, the Media Government Office in Gaza reports that at least 183 of them have been journalists over the last year. That's about three journalists killed a week. With exceptions that the authors cite, what's missing is the wide-scale understanding that journalists are not just information sources. They are memory keepers. When a reporter is assassinated, the stories that they didn't publish, the voices that are not recorded, are stolen as well. Israel's war on Gaza is not only a land grab, as its leaders have explicitly stated, it's also a theft of invaluable Palestinian memory and history. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In August 2017, the specter of white supremacists marching with guns and torches, throwing KKK salutes, and screaming about Jews and commies offered a test for Americans. One of the primary institutions we hoped would be asking themselves some questions was corporate media. The trouble is, the press remains among the most sacred of cows for the press. Not just Fox News, which aired a video of cars driving into protesters in January with instructions to viewers to study the technique, but also, say, CBS, whose CEO Les Moonves joked that Donald Trump's candidacy may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS, a line that has yet to be seriously interrogated by media elites. Counterspin talked at the time about corporate media's coverage and its aftermath with Adam Johnson, reporter and host with Nima Shirazi of the podcast Citations Needed. He joined us from a New York City taxi. People are bristling over Trump's blame on all sides line, but it's hard not to notice how that kind of echoes corporate media's own forced even-handedness. And in this case, that started from the very beginning with the language that was used to describe the act of James Fields ramming his car into other cars and into human beings.
Fairly early on, you saw very suspicious agency-less language about how one died, 20 injured after clashes in Charlottesville. It's a way that you launder responsibility. It's a very odd and awkward form of grammatical formation. So it's stark when you read it. A guy ran a car into a crowd of people and killed one person. And to say that one person dies after clashes is a way of, again, removing agency and removing who did what to whom. It's a very curious way of phrasing it. In a similar vein, you also saw the repeated use of the car as some kind of autonomous or kind of Knight Rider entity. So, for example, the editorial for the Washington Post, they said, that car did not just ram into 20 people. So, but of course, the car didn't ram into people. Fields ran into people. A person ran into people. And that, you know, a Nazi sympathizer, Nazi terrorist, whatever more loaded term you want to use would probably be far more accurate than the idea that the car, again, was somehow autonomous or itself racist. Now, some people would say, okay, well, it's, you know, it's a legal issue or they don't want to, you know, that's what the word allegedly is there for. And that term is used all the time when it comes to African-American suspects, as we've written before.
Right. Well, so then Trump has this press conference about how
You know, you can't just assume that a person carrying a torch and screaming Jews will not replace us is some sort of supremacist. But then also, what about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? Isn't that line, in maybe just a more edumacated version, also something that we're seeing in the media? What's the alt-left?
Well, the alt-left was something that was originally kind of used by Sean Hannity, but it was quickly adopted either indirectly or directly from centrist and liberal pundits to smear typically Sanders supporters or people that were not. It was kind of three categories. It was the Sanders contingent who were, you know, kind of mean online. It was also used for people who opposed intervention in the narrative in Syria. You actually saw a lot of it used from the likes of Michael White, Nick Cohen. He would use it to smear people who didn't fall in line in the, you know, the Assad Must Go camp. And then the third thing was it was used for Antifa and a lot of the anarchists and leftists who were out protesting or directly combating, if you will, white supremacists. And so it kind of just became this catch-all for anyone to the left of Hillary Clinton I don't like.
Well, and language is so important. I mean, the opposite of Nazi is not Nazi, you know, but if you use alt-left and alt-right, there's a definite implication that you're talking about people whose views are equivalent or a counterbalance, right?
I mean, alt effectively became a fascist or Nazi qualifier. So to use alt-left, you were basically saying that they were morally equivalent. I mean, there really is no other excuse to use that way. It was done in a kind of reactionary, lazy way, right? Because they needed a shorthand to replace Bernie Bro. And once the primary started blowing out at around July and August of last year, they had to have a replacement because you couldn't just call everyone a Bernie Bro anymore. So there needed to be a new pejorative for people who were to the left of Hillary Clinton. And alt-left, because it was so charged and so lazy and so convenient, was just mindlessly adopted without appreciating that what they were in fact doing was creating this both sides of them. You were drawing moral equivalence between people who wanted free health care and people who wanted to eliminate the Jewish race.
Well, I got an email yesterday from Jason Kessler, the organizer of the Unite the Right rally, in which he flat out declared that the protesters, the ones with the torches and the metal poles and the guns, held zero responsibility for violence. The violence is entirely due to the police failure to protect them from counter-protesters. That's his line, and he's sticking to it. Now, I don't know what's in his head, or this guy Christopher Cantwell releasing a video of himself weeping about what a peaceful guy he is, though he's on tape saying, I'm carrying a pistol, I go to the gym all the time, I'm trying to make myself more capable of violence. It becomes, who do you believe, you know, me or your lying eyes. But as long as corporate press can be relied on to say that the truth is in the middle, to triangulate, it's going to be a strategy. It's like a winning strategy for the right to make as wild a claim as they can.
Yeah, because the media in general, and this is obviously generalization, but Their first instinct is to strip ideology from the conversation, whereas one ideology is genocidal, one ideology is anti-genocide. Well, let's split the difference. And you see this a lot with the use of the word fascist. They'll say, oh, you know, some people say there's fascists on the left. And it's like, well, you know, fascist doesn't mean people that are mean. Fascist doesn't even mean people that are violent. Fascist is a specific ideology which traffics in eugenics and racial superiority. Again, people who are mean to me on the internet is not the same thing as a Nazi or a fascist. And people who don't really have a hard ideology, which a lot of people in media don't, well, I mean, they do in the sense that they don't think they do, but they don't have one they can sort of pinpoint and locate. They view all kinds of aggression and all kinds of violence as the same, as morally the same. And what Trump was doing was simply an extension of the kind of narrative the media themselves had been engaging in. It was just jarring to hear someone say it who you assumed was saying it because they were soft-pedaling Nazism. You know, but again, the argument he was making was not really much different than one that had been made by liberals and centrists since the beginning of these large right-wing rallies that we've been seeing emerging in the Trump era.
Well, let me ask you finally about what we're expecting to see going forward. I know that one thing I kind of knew was coming, and then there it was right away, was a column in the Washington Post, An Honest Conversation About Race Is Not Allowed, and it's by this guy who's a publisher of the Times Gazette in Hillsboro, Ohio. And he says, racism, the belief that an entire race of people is inherently inferior or superior to another race of people, is abhorrent. And then he goes on to say, by contrast, simply disagreeing with affirmative action programs or supporting a crackdown on crime or wanting to rein in government spending on domestic programs or opposing sanctuary cities is not racism. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that.
Yeah, this is the kind of literal-minded argument that, like, Bill O'Reilly's always make, where they say, I'm not against Mexicans, I'm just against illegal immigration, which ends up, of course, not being true, because now Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump are going after legal immigration. So that whole facade is no longer there. You know, of course, things like sanctuary cities and clamping down on welfare, I mean, these are deeply racially charged, and he's acting all Pollyannish about it. Like, shucks, I can't believe it. I mean, you know, this is the literal-minded bull that the kind of non-overt racists in the Republican Party have been doing for years, of course. And I think everyone sees through it. It's a shame that they're giving these people voices, but it's the equivalent of, you know, you come over to my house and you open the fridge and I say, have whatever you like, and you take the ice cube trays. I mean, of course there's subtext to language. Of course there's meaning to these things. Look, the poll taxes in Jim Crow South that was the same argument they used, right? It was the idea that, we just want to make sure that they pass a citizenship test. It's like, okay.
I take hope in the fact that you think folks are seeing through this at this point. We're going to be seeing people say, oh, the thing that I've been saying all along, my anti-poor, anti-immigrant, pro-incarceration, that's very different because you've never seen me carrying a torch, you know? But you think folks are smarter than that?
I think that not to use too Marxist of a term here, but I think the tensions are being highlighted here, right? The cracks in the system are exposing themselves, and I feel like the people who've been dog whistling all these years are starting to become more overt. Now, you know, you still have the Mitt Romneys of the world who want to make sure that we talk in the appropriate code. But I think people know we're are seeing how the Republicans are responding to Trump, which is basically to kind of shrug and send subtweets. And I think their cowardice is being exposed. And, of course, by not saying anything, they're a party to it. Hopefully that'll galvanize more people on the left moving forward.
We've been speaking with FAIR analyst Adam Johnson. He's also host of the podcast Citations Needed, and he's on Twitter at Adam Johnson NYC. Adam, thanks very much for talking with us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
That was writer and Citations Needed podcast host Adam Johnson speaking with Counterspin in August 2017. Images of weeping toddlers torn from their mother's arms, of children in cages, or what some insist you call chain-link fenced holding areas, and of three-year-olds representing themselves in deportation or asylum proceedings. In 2018, those images were outraging and galvanizing many Americans in protest of the first Trump administration's racist, cruel, anti-immigration and anti-immigrant policies. While some reporters were new to the story, Counterspin spoke with someone who'd been organizing against the criminalization of Latinx and immigrant communities for years. Jacinta Gonzalez is senior campaign organizer at Mi Gente, the national political hub for Latinx organizing. Counterspin spoke with her in July of 2018.
Families belong together has broad appeal as an idea, broad surface appeal, if I may say. Even media who are trying hard have had trouble finding people to give a full-throated endorsement of the idea of pulling children from their parents who are trying to enter the country. That is beyond, well, they brought this on themselves, you know. But the power of positive messaging aside, is it your sense that families belong together is just not a sufficient organizing principle for bringing about the real change that we want to see? How do we need to grow that idea?
I think what we saw clearly with this newly created crisis by this administration is that when we simply demand things like family unity, what we get is family unity behind bars. And so for us, it was really necessary to be able to raise awareness of not only what was happening with the devastation of young children being separated from their parents, but also with the criminalization of migration and mass prosecutions of folks who are entering this country. Because with this analysis, we're able to actually make demands that would get to the root of the problem instead of just treating the most horrific, but yet the manifestation of the actual policy.
Right. Well, in your very straightforward piece, How to Stop Child Separation, Stop Sending Their Parents to Prison, that you wrote last month for Truthout, You talked about, you know, if we really want to go forward from this and we want to use our very warranted feelings of upset and anger at what we're seeing to really end the crisis, there are a number of elements of that work that we could be looking at. What are some of the things that you're pointing to that folks might direct energy to?
We put out a policy platform that kind of describes that there's both movement demands that we're making, but there's also really concrete things that both Congress can do, different government agencies can do to try to get us a little bit closer to the real solution to some of these problems. For us, a primary demand or a central tenet is the abolishment of ICE as an agency. We know that family separation has been happening not only at the border, but also when deportations are taking place and parents are being separated from their families, but also community members more broadly are being separated from their loved ones and from people that they share their lives with. And so we think that ICE as an agency should be completely abolished, which means there should be a moratorium on deportations. There should be a defunding of the agency. We should end all forms of detention. And those are very concrete demands that can be accomplished now. But we also point to the need to decriminalize migration. You know, the laws that are on the books that are allowing Jeff Sessions to throw the book at people are laws that were written in the 1930s by a legislator that was openly advocating for lynching, that was against interracial marriage, and that promoted the criminalization of migration. And so it's time for us to take a strong stand and decriminalize that as well by taking away Section 1325 and 1326 that allows for these prosecutions to happen.
I think we did start to see maybe an advance over the conversation that we had around DACA and the Dreamers, which was very much about let's not punish these innocent children for the crimes of their parents. And it was this very invidious and kind of confused understanding of what crime is and of what it means to try to isolate. I mean, to me, it reminded me, frankly, of the welfare reform conversation around 1996, where we had media talking about, yes, let's punish these lazy mothers, but how do we protect their children? You know, it's a very kind of artificial conversation. But I feel as though things have maybe moved on a little bit from that to where we can see a distinction between crime and criminalization, you know, making things a crime. I don't know. Am I too optimistic there? Or do you think people are starting to understand what it really means to criminalize immigration itself?
I think we see tendencies going both ways. Mm-hmm. So I actually think there's a lot of things that are really exciting about seeing people broaden their analysis of criminalization and their understanding of policing. Understanding that Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol are policing agencies, and so that a lot of the same critiques that can be applied to ICE also apply to the police. And so it kind of broadens the conversation and the possibilities of what we can do and what kinds of alliances we can build, particularly between Black and Latinx communities. But you also have, I think there's a tendency in the center to try to say that this is not the time for radical demands that actually give different possibilities, that we should say things like, well, we'll give you the wall, but legalize this many people.
Right.
And I think we've seen a couple of rounds of that. You know, we had legislators saying that they would negotiate with Trump on some of these policies, knowing full well the far, far right-wing agenda that he's pushing. So I think we also have to see the opportunity of being able to have more people understand the criminalization, and I think we also have to be wary of not taking advantage of this moment because it's unveiling what the system truly is meant to do. And so these are the moments where we can actually provide other options and alternatives to folks beyond what many mainstream Democrats have been presenting as solutions.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about that vision. The International Red Cross just released a report talking about the new walled order, as they put it, and saying that criminalizing aid and public services for immigrants and migrants is setting back advances by a century. And what they're calling for is just a simple separation from immigration policy and from those policies regarding access to food and health care and legal advice, you know. So they're also applying it to the French mayor who said that distributing food at a migrant camp was illegal, and the Italian government that's saying NGOs can't go out into Libyan waters with search and rescue missions and all of that. I feel that that international vision is necessary to broadening the context of what's happening at just the U.S.-Mexico border, which you've just indicated is really not only about the U.S.-Mexico border. But I think an international vision and a bigger picture of migration worldwide would help here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have to have a broader vision of migration because, you know, migration has been happening for centuries. And given the increases in wealth disparities and the added crisis of climate change, we're going to be seeing more and more of it. And unfortunately, for a lot of countries, the response has been a militarized criminalization of migration that is creating a worse human rights crisis, but also creating economic incentives for people to try to continue to promote an agenda of dealing with it that increases countries' ability to incarcerate, to surveil, to police. And so I do think we have to understand this within the broader context and also understand it, again, within the framework of if we continue to have a system that responds to everything with punishment and criminalization, we're going to continue to confront this better over and over again, and not just in migration. You know, we're seeing it with reproductive justice issues. We're seeing it with climate justice. We're seeing it with the legal justice system that this country also uses. And so I think we have to have a broader analysis that connects all of those dots.
Well, let me just bring you back finally, if I could, to the idea of abolishing ICE, which I think is fascinating. I've heard it said, you know, it's one of those things that is presented as, well, you can't get rid of a government agency, even if it's an agency that only recently came into existence. And part of what I hate, frankly, about corporate media is the way that they try to limit our political possibilities. So abolishing ICE is the kind of idea that the corporate media will tell us is laughable and impossible until we do it, and then they'll act like they invented it. And I just wonder, how do you encourage people to think around the ideas and the limitations that they're getting from news media, for example, and do the work outside of that and get beyond of that? I feel like work that occurs outside the media lens in some ways is free from some of the limitations that media try to present to people about what is possible and what can happen.
ICE as an agency was only created with the purpose of detaining and deporting people. It was, in fact, designed as an agency to terrorize immigrant communities. And so I think that it is very possible and realistic to get rid of it. There are a million other agencies that help in different parts of immigration laws in this country, and you don't need ICE to be able to do the other functions. So I think it's very possible to completely get rid of it, have a moratorium on deportations, defund ICE as an agency, restructure resources, and there doesn't have to be a replacement. I think we have to be very concerned with people who are advocating that it be readjusted and housed within the Department of Justice. I think we're seeing the worries of what can happen with the Department of Justice, who that is only aimed at incarcerating people. Housing our immigration policies there would only make that worse. So I actually think we have to be able to reimagine different structures. And I think what we're seeing is that also the American public has an appetite for it. We saw it with the most recent victory of different congressional representatives that are running in New York, but I think we've seen it with over 100 candidates coming out publicly to support the demand. We're able to do it as a policy, and it's a platform that people will vote for.
That was Jacinta Gonzalez of Mi Gente speaking with Counterspin in the summer of 2018. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From the UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, this is Democracy Now!
The IPCC is clear in terms of our capacity still to be able to reach a strong 2030 goal. And that could happen if we focus our efforts and if we are able to create a process of synergy, collaboration, and global solidarity.
As negotiations continue here at the UN Climate Summit, we'll speak to Colombia's chief negotiator, Environment Minister Susana Mohamed. She just chaired the UN Biodiversity Conference in Cali. We'll talk about Colombia's pledge to phase out fossil fuels, efforts to decrease deforestation, and Colombia's coal embargo on Israel over the war on Gaza. Susana Mohamed is a Colombian of Palestinian descent. Then we'll look at the growing debate over nuclear power as Google, Amazon, and Microsoft invest in nuclear plants to power their artificial intelligence projects. But first, we'll speak to the daughter of Gubad Ibadolu, a prominent Azerbaijani activist and anti-corruption economist, now under house arrest.
They also tortured him in detention center. He did not have access to drinkable water. He did not access the proper food, medication, doctor visit. He was not allowed to be even visited by International Committee of Red Cross.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from Baku, Azerbaijan, from the UN Climate Summit. In northern Gaza, at least 17 Palestinians were killed Monday when Israel's military bombed a home near the hospital in Beit Lahia. The dead were members of the family of Dr. Hani Badran, one of the few remaining medical workers at Kamal Adwan Hospital. Video shows hospital director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who lost his own son to an Israeli airstrike last month, comforting Dr. Badran after delivering the news. The hospital since come under fresh attacks by Israeli forces who shelled and fired on the building, including right outside Dr. Abu Safia's office. Dr. Abu Safia reports wounded patients are dying daily due to a severe lack of doctors and medical supplies. Elsewhere, an Israeli airstrike on a house in Gaza City Monday killed 7 Palestinians and wounded 10 others. Survivors said the strike came without warning.
We were at home having breakfast. I went out and suddenly heard the sound of a bombing. I returned back thinking it was another house that was hit. I saw the whole house was damaged. I started searching and discovered all of the murderers were kids. All of those who were at home were elderly, children and infants. They were all women. Who else would be there? All of the men were at work.